Okay, let us continue. So let's suppose that we have mindfulness, investigation, energy, joyfulness, all well established. Then we can begin to turn our attention to training the mind. When I use this phrase, training the mind, very, very important to acknowledge in Buddhist psychology that there is no distinction made between mind and heart. So it's training the mind, it's training the heart. What are we training the mind to do? Very simply, we're training the mind to be a friend. I would put it that simply. Training the mind to be a friend. Now, it's interesting, there are many of the discourses, because the next of these links is pasadi. It actually translates as tranquility. And if we think of that in verb form, tranquilizing the mind, doesn't actually sound that inspiring. And probably drugs is an easier way, but it's really about calming. It's about stilling. A calming and stilling the formations, the very introduction to the teachings of mindfulness. Breathing in, calming the formations, breathing out, calming the formations, stilling everything that is agitated. Now, it's worth noting in the discourses that the way the Buddha frames this, because he says, you know, in a mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation. It's kind of the reverse of what we would sort of think, isn't it? That in a mind of happiness, attention finds a true foundation. So in many ways, if we were to think of these supports of awakening in a linear way, we are actually establishing a foundation of happiness or well-being through the cultivation of joyfulness, through the cultivation of investigation, where we're no longer caught in the arguments, through bringing the efforts to actually kind of point our attention in the direction of freedom and awakening, rather than being lost in the habit patterns. We are actually, through these, really beginning to develop a mind of happiness. It's for me, this is often important, because it sounds strange, you know, because often when people come to meditative practice, you know, not always, but it's not uncommon that people come with, you know, bringing their whole life with them. You know, with all of the things that are troubled and conflicted, and, you know, the things that feel troubled and conflicted inwardly. And, you know, I think if we did a survey at the beginning of a meditation retreat, you know, is everybody happy? You know, I doubt if we would get 100%, you know, yes response. So the happiness that is kind of really spoken about here, I think, is not perhaps our usual framing of happiness, but I think it is pointing towards the mind that has really begun to step out of the argument. I think you can also really relate to this, because you know what it is like when your mind is caught in the argument with how things should be, or, you know, how they should be different than they are, how I should be different, you should be different, about how much narrative is involved in that. You know, it is often so, so very, very busy. So learning actually to step out of that proliferation is part of developing this link of serenity or calming. And again, I want to point out the distinction here between a state and a process. You know, because often pasadi is translated as calmness, but it's actually translated as calming. You know, because again, when we start to think of states, we think of one state versus another state, you know, and calmness means that, you know, there's no agitation present, or there's no restlessness present, or there's no, aversion present. What we're engaging here is in the process of calming, stilling all that is agitated. And a lot of this involves taking away the fuel of agitation. Doesn't mean that agitation is not present, but we actually have taken a course of action inwardly, a behavioral gesture of the mind, of not fueling the agitation. Now, this is, again, it's kind of countercultural, I have to say, because I think we live in times where there's something of an addiction to intensity. You know, intensity makes us feel awake, intensity makes us feel alive, you know, intensity seems to bring meaning, you know, whereas actually here we're actually learning to undo that addictive pattern that is really bound around, you know, the extremes of intensity. So calming is very much in relationship to this hindrance pattern of agitation, of restlessness and worry. This is much of what we're involved in calming. And I really want to stress that this is not just an on-the-cushion practice. You know, if we make that division between on-the-cushion practice and what we do elsewhere, our achievement level is going to be really quite limited in this. You know, there's plenty of people who can sit, you know, and focus their mind and then get off the cushion and jump into patterns of agitation. So this is much about what happens off the cushion as happens on the cushion. And it's interesting that this really does begin with calming the body. It really begins with calming the body. I mean, we get the felt sense of what agitation, what does agitation do to your body? Any? Clenching, tightness,
stress,
busyness, fidgetiness, movement, you know, the whole shebang, you know. So we really actually begin this process much more through the vehicle of the body, of beginning to calming the body. This also includes calming the sense doors. We talked about this yesterday, about how agitation often registers in the hungriness of the eyes, you know, the hungriness of the sense doors to make contact with more and more sensory information. It is actually quite a wonderful practice, by the way, calming the body. You know, there are so many opportunities to do this. You know, you sit in the car, you sit on a bus, you know, you sit on a plane, you move through a street, calming the body. As an intention, this is really something worthwhile taking up. It's that ability to find some stilling in the midst of busyness, in the midst of an agitated world, to find some stilling inwardly. And it is so interesting, if you have that intention of stilling and calming the body, how the mind actually responds to that. You know, it's actually quite, you know, it tends to follow the lead. It picks up the clues. Aware very much about how the body becomes a vehicle for an agitated mind. And then we actually start to look, what does the Buddha mean by calming the agitations? What is it that's agitated? Well, all of the hindrance factors we spoke about yesterday are agitations. Yeah? Aversion is an agitation, you know. Restlessness is an agitation. Craving is an agitation. Doubt is an agitation. The only one that doesn't look like an agitation is sloth and torpor. But perhaps that's just the, you know, the checkout factor from all of the exhaustion, from all of the rest of the agitations. But when you look at the nature, the kind of felt sense of any of those hindrance patterns, selfing is an agitation. When we look at the felt sense of all of those factors, you know, the common theme is this sense of agitation, of being stirred up. So that what actually fuels the agitation, the primary fuel of most agitation, is actually unskillful thought. If you want, yeah, and the Buddha used this metaphor so quickly. You know, if you want to keep a fire burning, just keep throwing logs on it. And what are the logs we throw on our fires? It's mostly thought. And then we come across this most wonderful Pali word, the one that everybody should learn, papancha. Huh? And people not familiar with the word papancha? Okay. Papancha is a beautiful word. I'll translate it. It's the proliferation of thinking generated by underlying beliefs and views that distorts our capacity to see things the way they actually are. The generation and proliferation of thinking generated by underlying beliefs and views that distorts our capacity to see things the way they actually are. Okay, so we come back to this phrase, to see things the way they actually are. So this is the primary fuel for agitation, is papancha. In fact, one of the synonyms for nibbana is nipapancha. The cessation of proliferation. The cessation of proliferation. Now, papancha is something very easy to track in our experience. But again, it has its own subcategories. And these are quite useful to actually track in your own experience, because I think it's part of developing that kind of literacy of what is actually fueling the agitations. So here's the word, papancha. So we have craving-based papancha. We have aversion-based papancha. We have view-based papancha. We have fear-based papancha. And we have what's called mana papancha. And actually, that's the story of me. That's the story of me. Now, traditionally, fear actually comes under the umbrella of aversion-based papancha, but in my experience and experience of listening to people, the contents of fear-based papancha look a little different than aversion-based papancha. Take much more the theme of worry and apprehension and anxiety, whereas aversion-based papancha has a different kind of felt sense. So these are actually the tendencies that fuel papancha. Now, these tendencies in Pali, I don't know if you're interested in this whatsoever, but these tendencies in Pali are called anusyas. And translated, anusyas means to leak. To leak. We are leaking craving through the thinking processes. We are leaking aversion through the thought processes. You know? So this is the way, remember we came back to Sankhara Dukkha? The Dukkha of patterns? These anusyas are the ways, are sankharas, and sankharas that leak through the thought processes. Okay, so this is the way that agitation is fueled when untended to. Actually, the more accurate translation other than leakages is effluent. So this is what is being leaked. Buddhist psychology is quite graphic in this. But you get a sense of this. Now, what does this papancha do to us? What does it do to us? It shapes the mind and it shapes the world. Now, you could almost say that all of the forms of papancha are just different branches of mana papancha, or different branches of the self story. That would not be inaccurate to say that. But it's quite useful to actually get a sense that, you know, it's not just that we have thought storms. We have particular flavorings in the thought storms. Some people will have more expertise in one than another, but that will depend on the view that they hold about themselves. So our papancha expertise is going to have some relationship to the self-view that is held. Does that make sense to you? So if there's going to be a calming of the agitations, it's going to be a question of stop throwing logs on the fire. Stop throwing logs. I mean, by the way, this is particularly none of these have a particularly pleasant feel, by the way. You have a question? Views. Oh, views are confusing. Just turn on your news. Pick up a newspaper. You know, listen to a lot of social discourse, how it's one view versus another view. We don't even know that we have views until we run up against an opposing view. You know, and then it's, that's not how life is. You know, that's not how the world is. You know, that's not how people are. You know, they are our political views, all of the views that we form about how things are according to my story. And then just going on and on about it. Yes, just going on and on about it. So you have a sense that if we want to calm the agitations, we actually need to learn how to step out of the papancha circles, because these are not places of happiness, they're not places of stilling. You know, they are actually, the papancha is self-building, papancha is almost self-perpetuating, and it is such a powerful habit of our minds, which actually have the capacity, really, for such stillness and spaciousness and clarity. This is just static. Yeah? A lot of static, but it's not neutral static. So our thinking streams have an emotional charge, and the emotional charge is what are called the anusyas. The anusyas are one of the manifestations of avidya, of ignorance. This is how ignorance leaks. This is how ignorance leaks. Now, this distorts our capacity to see things the way that they actually are, because we get very, very convinced by our thought storms. If you might have noticed this, They have a certain authority, they gain a certain authority. And, you know, sometimes we do this collectively, don't we? We don't just do it individually. You know, we're very generous and we like, you know, papancha likes company, you could say. You know, so if I'm in a view-based papancha storm, I'd really like to seek out some people who hold some similar views. You know, if I'm in an aversion papancha storm, it's great, you know, to find people who are going to actually legitimize that, you know. So papancha likes company often. So this is actually the first step. Yes, please. Yeah, views are used in a very specific way in Buddhist psychology. It's a solidification of a distortion. It's a solidification of a distortion. You are like this, I am like that, the world is like this. So it's like the solidification of a distortion, which is very, very different than ethics or values or aspirations or anything of that nature, which is not clung to, because the solidification of views is what is woven into our sense of self. You know, this is who we are. So it's used in a very, very specific way as a solidification of distortion. That's not necessarily a view. That might actually be a skillful identity you've cultivated. No, I think so. It might be. I mean, it's a good reminder, because it's very important to stress, you know, that Buddhist teaching is not valueless. It is infused with value. And the values it is infused with are the values that are rooted in ethics, okay, and aspirations and sense of possibility. It's always infused with actually wholesome values. So it's not valueless. Whereas views can be wholesome. Actually, there are some wholesome views, and views can be unwholesome. So they're ethically variable. They're ethically variable, our views. That might be a better way of putting it. But if they're clung to, then they become distortions. Then they become self-builders. Okay?
So wholesome views are right views.
Eightfold Path begins with right view. Seeing things the way they actually are. Knowing dukkha, the causes of dukkha. Knowing the three characteristics. Removing distortion. However, in another discourse, the Buddha would say to cling to no view of self is to cling to no view at all. Ah, so we have this word clinging introduced here. Even in the text it says clinging to values turns what starts out as being ethically wholesome into something that is ethically questionable. And we certainly see this, don't we, in many fundamentalist beliefs, where something that started out as quite wholesome, when it's clung to, becomes actually quite unwholesome because it's turned into a view of me versus this. That's why it's ethically variable. So, learning to cool papancha, learning to step out of papancha, I think is really a very experiential exploration. And a little bit of it comes back to what I was speaking about before lunch, about the various aspects of wise effort. Because papancha is very trapping, isn't it? We feel trapped by it. It's not like it feels like it's chosen or intentional or like we have a choice. You know what papancha is like when it just feels like the record is going round and round and round? You know, it's not like we just feel that we've got this choice, I think I'll put this down. Papancha has got us. You know, we don't have papancha. Papancha has got us. You know, it's as we so captured the attention. So we refer back to some of those applications of skillful effort I was speaking about before lunch. You know, first we have to know it. Then we develop a kind of literacy about it. Okay, what's the particular flavor here? We might actually develop a somatic awareness of it. How is that impacting in the body? We might actually do a bit of investigation. How is this shaping my world of the moment? And following on from that, because papancha can have such a grip, I mean, this is what, you know, quite frankly, it's a psychological vandalism. You know, then we might, and it's so habitual that we might actually need to explore some of those dimensions of effort I was speaking about earlier, of taking our attention elsewhere, you know, of cultivating what is missing. Sometimes even the tongue against your roof of your mouth, you know, but to actually begin to take the fuel, the fire away, to stop feeding the fire, because I have never seen one single strand of papancha that is good for anybody. So this is what we are calming, this is what we are stilling, and we will do this through the body, sometimes we will do it through skillful efforts, but first we need to lose our enchantment with it. You know, we need to lose our enchantment, the enchantment we often have with those stories. And that in itself, for many people, is actually the biggest challenge of all. By the way, this doesn't mean that we stop thinking. Doesn't mean that we make an enemy out of thought. But I think you might discover that the degree to which the mind is liberated from the papancha habit is the degree to which your mind has access to creative, reflective, meaningful thinking that is appropriate to the moment. Any questions about that? So,
I was just thinking that, thinking about the hindrances, that Papancha seems like with doubt is a potent kind of potency.
Yeah. Yeah. Doubt, all of the hindrances are big Papancha generators, apart from sloth and torpor, you know, where it's usually retrospectively a big Papancha generator. But all of the other hindrance factors are major Papancha generators, and Papancha is a self-generator, self-builder. The hindrances are actually sustained by Papancha. Any? We hear. Okay, so if we do begin to actually and have the willingness, and willingness is a big piece here, you know, the willingness to step out of our Papancha streams, because as I mentioned, you know, there's a very major addictive quality to all of this. You know, it makes us feel alive. It's how we're making sense of the world. It's what's giving meaning. It's, you know, building a sense of self. It's it's kind of describing, you know, it's putting the world in its places, you know. So there's a very major addictive quality to this. So if we can find the willingness to begin to step out of this, then there's a chance of this next limb of awakening to emerge, which is samadhi. Samadhi. Again, this is it's very often, I think, quite badly translated as wise concentration. The better translation of samadhi is a little bit what I've been mentioning in some of the practice instructions. It's unification. It's unification of body, mind, and present moment. The integration of body, mind, and present moment. It's a sense of collectedness. You know, going back to that image I used of you know, either the cow herding or the sheepdogs gathering the sheep. The sense of collectedness and moving our attention from pastures that don't serve us well, Papancha, into pastures that do serve us well, which is the present moment recollection, the present moment awareness. So it's moving our attention from the fields where we're actually kind of malnourished into the fields where we're actually being nourished and where we can begin to thrive. I mean, the reason I have some reluctance to the translation of concentration is I think when, you know, when many people think of concentration, they think of this sort of, you know, this almost like this forced, exclusive kind of attention. Whereas samadhi can be very one-pointed with an object. Samadhi can also be very inclusive in terms of moving from one object to another.
So how is it different from sati then?
Samadhi is actually, I talked about all the different nuances of sati.
Yeah.
The samadhi part would tend to come more into this first nuance, but don't try and make a direct parallel, that's what I would say, okay? Because sati establishes the foundation for developing samadhi, okay? So this is, we're talking here about a really quite refined inner collectedness, where sati has that very broad spectrum of meanings that I was referring to yesterday, okay? Unification, integration. So samadhi is, as I mentioned, is seen in two different ways. One way it's seen is in terms of very deep meditative development. Okay? And this is where samadhi will go into things like, you know, absorption states and jhanas and, you know, very, very refined states of meditative development. That's one thread. But the other thread, and quite frankly, by the way, absorption states are not necessarily, you know, accurate measures of people's meditative progress. Please know that. Absorption states are as much a question of temperament as anything else. You know, some of the wisest people I know have never had an absorption state. So it's almost a question of temperament as anything. But they're useful. They can be useful. But the samadhi we're talking about here is not something that is reserved for a cushion. It is this unification, integration, inner collectedness with which we move through life. With which we move through life. Now, this actually quite... I think this is the Achilles heel of most people's practice, in my experience. Yeah? We are, the mind is so prone to being unsettled and so prone to distractedness and so prone to mind-body fragmentation rather than unification. I think this really is, in my experience, the Achilles heel of most people's practice. This is actually where we learn to put a lot of attention. Because it's not even as if samadhi is an end in itself, but samadhi makes the mind so receptive to understanding, so receptive to insight. And it is just so easy to lead a very distracted life. You know, the absence of samadhi in the imagery is often used, the image that is used is of a monkey jumping from branch to branch, you know, unable to settle anywhere. The Buddha compares the non-samadhi mind, to a fish taken out of water that's just flopping around on the ground. Unable to be still, unable to thrive, actually. So, where should I go with this? There's a lot in samadhi that is to do with renunciation. You know, the renunciation of distractedness, the renunciation of our enchantment with papancha, the renunciation of our infatuation with intensity. There is so much, so many ways in which samadhi is related to our capacity to unbind from the habit patterns of agitation. And we do need to remember that the habit patterns of agitation simply do not have an independent self-existence. You know, they are sustained by how they are nourished. So samadhi often signals not only a change of mind, quite frankly, sometimes it signals a change of life. It doesn't mean that you're being asked to renounce your kids and, you know, and your job and, you know, retreat to a monastery, none of that. But the renunciation of a way of life which is actually defined by how much stimulation we can make contact with. This is, again, I think you can see some threads coming together here, can't you? Threads of contentment. Threads of inwardly generated joyfulness, you know, a love of calming rather than a love of intensity. You know, I think you can have a sense of how many of these threads are actually coming together in the cultivation of samadhi, which is not a state we gain, it is a quality we cultivate. I'm very fond of using IKEA as a teaching model. It's the most fascinating teaching model of all, because there's a great deal of psychological thought that has gone into the construction of IKEA. So it's not randomly laid out the way it is around the world. You know, those folks know people's minds. And have you noticed, if I do a little spin on an IKEA story, have you ever hung out at the entrance to IKEA, you know, where you watch people arriving, all agog with excitement, you know, straining at the bit to get in there. And then you know how you have to follow the line? And if you go off the line, you know, you're lost. I imagine IKEA's filled with people, you know, lost souls who've never made it out, you know. And you know, halfway, you know, you're losing hope, and you get a few meatballs, you know, that picks you up, you know, and off you go again. You're back on the line. But if you get off the line, you're going to go to Housewares 20 times, and you're going to think, I'm going to be in Housewares forever. Do you get the thread with how our minds work? You know? So, and have you looked at people leaving IKEA? Haggard, you know, exhausted, worn out, and dragging along these pieces that don't fit together, and they know they're going to have to make another trip for the bit they didn't get. You know. Anyway, so I find it's a fascinating model of samsara. You know, this is a samsara. You know, this is a samsara embodied. You know, so I have learned a lesson. If you go to IKEA, you must keep your attention on the exit sign. It's not just the line. You have to keep your attention on the exit sign. You have to stick to your list, and then you're likely to survive. Isn't that a model for this teaching? You know, isn't that just a model for his teaching? You know where you're going. Keep your eye on the exit sign. Don't get distracted. Don't forget your list. You know, don't get off the list. Don't get distracted. Keep your eye on the exit sign, and you're likely to come out still smiling. But you will get out. Now, samadhi is actually, you know, in this model, first of all, you might just not go in. unless you absolutely were obliged to. But samadhi in this model is actually keeping your attention on what is important. It's keeping your attention on what is important, knowing that if you lose sight of that and you go down the papancha track, you are going to visit Housewares 20 times. And you're going to keep wondering, how did I get there? Until you realize you'd lost the exit sign. So samadhi is that sense of really, you know, really beginning to love non-distractedness. You know, really beginning to love stillness. Really beginning to love calmness. You know, to have a greater passion for an inner collectedness than the passion we have for being stimulated, or the passion we have for intensity, or the passion we have for you know, excitement. It's really a remembering, I think, of what is really important. And then to look at how we practice that in our lives. And how we actually practice that in our lives. Because, you know, the world is not cooperating in a samadhi model. You may have noticed that. It's working on a different model. You know, our culture, generally speaking, is working on a different model. But samadhi is something that is cultivated moment to moment in the midst of those conditions. I think of it as a kind of airport practice. You know, if I'm going to an airport, I know what I'm doing, you know, I know where I need to go. And I've got, you know, duty free and all this sort of shouting at me, saying, you know, look at me, buy me, come here. Remember where you're going. And samadhi is what brings resilience to the mind, okay? It's what brings resilience to the mind. The mind that is lost in papancha has very little resilience. So this brings resilience to the mind, the ability to meet that world of conditions without being overwhelmed. And this is actually, and I'll just repeat myself endlessly on this, this is a moment-to-moment practice in the midst of all conditions. It's about the choices we're making about what we do with our attention. choices we're making about what we do with our attention. All right. Please.
You asked us in our last walking meditation to try and notice when we have a sense of samadhi and when it comes apart and when it comes back together. I felt very confused. Unification and collectedness sound very big and very wow. And is it something just very subtle of contentment? Like, what's the clue that I understand what this is?
So how do we know unification? How do we know this integration? Well, probably first we start to know disunification, where our body's in one place and our mind is in another. That's simple. I'm walking and I'm planning tomorrow. The body's walking, but the mind's not walking. The mind is doing something else. Or I'm walking and my sense doors are prowling. It's a kind of disembodied moment, moment of being. So the unification is actually when mind-body actually really feel to be in the same place in the same moment, engaged in the same intention, and the same embodied intention.
And the intention is to
be embodied. And to cultivate a present moment recollection. Disunification has become normalized.
I know, I don't recognize.
You know, it's kind of like the body begins here down.
So this is when you're walking, know you're walking.
When you're walking and you know you're walking and you're fully actually attentive and engaged in that walking. And the mind is not walking. The mind is in the body walking. Yeah. You're there. Yeah, you're there.
Okay.
And you could have another moment of walking where you start in that way and the pain appears and you suddenly start planning your hospital visit. And you feel that divide. You're not actually fully wholeheartedly collected in that moment. Don't make too big a thing of unification, of integration. It's simply mind-body occupying same moment, same space, same intention with awareness.
So it's more subtle than I'm imagining.
Yes, probably. But probably simpler than you're imagining. The last of these supports of awakening. Are you happy with samadhi? Are you unhappy with samadhi? What I really wanted to do with samadhi is to take it beyond this kind of limited perception of absorption states, meditative states, which, as I say, can be quite valuable, quite useful. Mostly temperamental, not essential, by the way, not essential.
Yes, if this doesn't fit, we'll
okay.
Stop it. Yesterday you said that you had made an intention to stop, I might have the word wrong, rushing.
Hurrying.
Hurry, thank you. And that it was so delicious that you decided to do that. Would that be a samadhi, that you move more to samadhi in that shift, in how you...
Well, hurrying is an agitation.
Right.
I mean, hurrying is a mind state of agitation. There's no calm in hurrying. It's all about really looking, where are the agitations in our life? You know? And usually when we look at the agitations in our life, we actually find how habitual they are. They're tracks, of almost like tracks of agitation. You know, this is the way I move through the world, or this is the way I drive my car, or this is the way I speak, or, you know, this is the way I cook, or, you know, we often find that there's tracks of agitation. You know, and so some of them, you know, it's actually looking on quite a basic level, behavioral level, often. Where are the tracks of agitation? And if we look closely at the tracks of agitation, we'll often find some of these anusyas lying behind them. You know, it might be impatience, might be frustration, it might be boredom. We'll often find some of these leakages lying behind them. But it's actually, and this is where the specificity of intentionality can be so helpful. You know, because you do find that if you undo one particular habit pattern of agitation, it starts to undo a whole bunch of others. You know? Because it's actually not the content of the habit pattern. It's the habit of the habit pattern. Yeah. It's the habit of the habit pattern rather than the particular way that it's manifesting. So if you have this specificity of intention, okay, let's just make this adjustment here. And let's see what it's like calming the agitation in this particular behavioral pattern. You know, so it's not necessarily virtuous, you know, that I do housework more calmly than somebody else. There's nothing virtuous in itself in that. But actually you do see that if you start to undo one pattern of agitation, you know, you start to undo the others. You know, there's a shift happening here in the mind, you know, because I think initially when many people start to practice, you know, agitation has actually become so normalized that it's hardly even noticed anymore. And what actually feels like an aberration is to bump up against a moment of calm. You know, I can't tell you how many times people have told me, I'm calm, it can't be true, you know. But what we're doing, shifting here through the cultivation of samadhi and collectedness, is actually making calm abiding more our natural resting place, so that a moment of agitation actually feels like an aberration. Do aspire.
I am.
Do aspire. Do aspire.
And inspired by you.
Yeah, do aspire. But, you know, you need to consider that shift because, as I've mentioned, agitation has become, you know, just normalized for so many that we don't even notice the discomfort of it until you can't sleep at night or you're exhausted or... Okay, so we have one more limb support of awakening really to look at, this quality of upekkha or equanimity. As I mentioned, this word is used interchangeably with nibbana. And although I think there's two different levels to equanimity. One is as a moment-to-moment cultivation, and one is as a fruition of understanding. And that's when it's equated with nibbana. But don't just elevate it to this place of fruition or awakening. You know, there's a reason why it's often put as the last of the limbs of awakening, because it's actually seen to be the fruition of all of the other limbs. You know, equanimity doesn't leave joyfulness behind. Equanimity doesn't leave investigation behind. It doesn't leave samadhi behind. It doesn't leave mindfulness behind. In a way, it is as if it's sometimes said to be the crown of all of the Brahmaviharas and the crown of all of the awakening supports. However, don't just elevate it to some impossible, you know, state. because equanimity is also a verb. I don't even know what it looks like as a verb. Equanimity. I know what it looks like as a verb. But it is also a very much a cultivation in the midst of all things. Okay, so it's sometimes described as being an unshakable poise, an unshakable sense of balance, of steadiness. It's really rooted in the maturity of renunciation or letting go. And actually you see this in the Satipatthana Sutta, the teaching of mindfulness, when you come to the line where it says, one who learns to abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. One who learns to abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. This is not describing a dissociative state. But one who abides independent, not clinging to anything in this world, it means also not being governed by the world of conditions. This is at the heart of much of the Buddha's teaching. It's a teaching of equanimity, where it really is described as this quality of inner freedom. Not just as a quality of wakefulness, but as a genuine quality of inner freedom. It's interesting, in the Pali, equanimity has two translations. One is, upekkha has two translations. One is indifference, and one is equanimity. It's the same word. And that's how closely that shadow side can be to equanimity. So clearly the quality of upekkha that the Buddha is speaking about is not the quality of indifference. It is the quality of poise and of balance. Mm-hmm.